We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you here. And we're also pleased to have here on the program in studio with us, Phil Nixon. He's an extension specialist in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences.
Crop Sciences.
Well, see, yeah, I got to fix it there, Phil. Crop Sciences. I'll just write that down there, Crop Sciences. Phil is here generally in the summertime. He's generous enough to come over and spend some time talking with us and try to help people out who have insect pest problems around the home. This could be something in the house, so we could be talking about ants, spiders, centipedes, roaches, what have you, or it could be something outside that attacks your ornamentals or things that you might want to eat in the garden. And if it's something, he's always been a good guy about saying, well, now, is this something that you can live with? And maybe you can and maybe you can't. But if you can't, he can tell you how to get rid of it, how to make it go away. So that's what we're doing here in the first part of the show. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Once again. Last time that Sandy was here, Sandy Mason, I know that we got a question from somebody about grubs. And so that's probably a good thing for us to talk about right off, because we were just talking here before we got going that it may actually even be a little bit past time to think about dealing with those, right?
Well, it's never too late as long as there's live grass out there, but they will, at this time of year, we're starting to see damage from white grubs, and what you'll see primarily are going to be brownish areas in turf, areas that look welded, a little bit off color, things of that nature, and sometimes people react to that by, oh, let's put a little more water on it, add some fertilizer. Before you do that, get you a serious knife, cut down through the turf, pull it back, see if you've got white grubs there in the root zone. They will be, if you've got 10 or 12 or more per square foot, they're probably causing the damage. Mm-hmm. And you can, and then scout other areas similarly by cutting through the turf in your lawn. Find out how widespread it is for four or more places around. Give you an idea whether your whole lawn, just your backyard, just your front yard, whatever, is involved. And then treat it with triclofan, which is sold as Dylox, D-Y-L-O-X. There are other insecticides that will work, too, if you've got something else in the garage that will probably work. But it will take longer than the Dylox. The Dylox will kill them in about 3 days. Mm-hmm. And water it in with a half an inch of water, and this will give you control and help keep from losing more of your grass. And the grass that's just showing a little bit of injury should come back.
All right, so it is the kind of thing that probably you should – well, first of all, you should know what it is, take a look at it. But if that's the problem, you would say it'd probably be a good idea to treat, or else it's likely that it will get worse, that you'll get a bigger area of die-off.
Yeah, and if you cut through there and you don't find any grubs, just don't say, well, we probably missed the grubs. It could be summer patch, could be some other things that are going on at this time of year that's making the brown spots in the area, but in the yard. But look for it. Check, make sure what you've got, attack it with some knowledge in hand rather than just guessing and, well, we'll throw this at it and see if that works, and then we'll throw something else at it and see if that works.
Okay. We have a caller here in Urbana. Why don't we talk with them on our line one, line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I work with the Idea Garden, and the other day, in particular the roses, when I was over there, the rose managers were surveying the plants, and the insects are building up. But the thing that was troubling was something seemed to be skeletonizing a large number of the leaves. And I glanced at the underside, and the first thing I saw were egg masses, very small eggs, maybe 50 to a mass, spread out over an area. And then I found some caterpillars, about maybe 3/8 of an inch long, sort of, I believe, a whitish, greenish white. I think they had black heads.
Kind of hairy looking?
Yes.
Okay. Could be a couple of different things. One is that the roses at the Idea Garden commonly get bristly rose slug. That tends to occur in the spring of the year. We normally look at it in June, and they will fit your description, although the eggs should be inserted into the leaves, you shouldn't be able to find the eggs open like that. But the larvae are going to be about 3/8 to a half an inch long, greenish, typically on the underneath side. They will do what we call window feed when they're young. They will eat partway through the leaf, and you'll have a clear area which will then turn brown. Because part of the leaf is still remaining and dies off. And then as they get older, they'll eat holes in the leaves. And so this could be the situation that's occurring. And they will have kind of bristles around on them. Another possibility it could be is our early stages of woolly bear attack. Yellow woolly bear is starting to become pretty numerous and small individuals. They're going to get up to probably 2 inches long, but they're going to be real fuzzy and whitish fuzzy type things. And they're going to be, they would do similar damage to a lot of plants, and I would not put it past them to damage roses. But I think it's probably bristly rose slug. Rose slugs are really a sawfly. They're not a larva of a butterfly or a moth, and so you can hand pick them if you want, but the number of leaflets on a rose bush makes that pretty hard to do. You could spray those with an insecticide such as Carbaryl, which is Soda-7. Or spinosad, which is sold as bullseye insecticide. Any pyrethroid, such as permethrin, sold as 8-insect spray or other brands, will give a good control. Because it's not a caterpillar, BTK, Bacillus thuringiensis Christachii, dipeptilothuricide will not work against them. If they are all fuzzy all over and whitish, then they're probably woolly bears, and all of the previous materials will work as well as BTK because they're a true moth larva.
Well, it was Saturday morning and there were a lot of people around, so I didn't want to use an insecticide. So mm-hmm. I had some BT in my van and I put that on. If it's a slug, obviously that's not going to
work. Yeah, you can lean over and listen to them and see if they're laughing at you and you know you proved the wrong thing. Now,
I may have heard something like that.
Thanks for the bath. We'll just keep working here, you know.
To be a very sensitive gardener to pick up on that.
Yeah.
Well, I thought I'd go over and check sometime today and see if they're still around.
Yeah, see if they're still around. I would say that if they're kind of more on the greenish than the whitish side, they're probably rose slugs, and all you did was give them a bath, and they're still doing their thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we shall find out.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. If you've got a bug problem in the house or in the garden and in the yard, you can give us a call and talk with our guest, Phil Nixon, and he can tell you what to do about it. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send along your questions by email if you'd like to do it like that. And that address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little bit about grubs. That's a seasonal thing. We probably always talk about this time of the year.
Yeah, one thing I forgot to mention was what white grubs will look like.
Oh, uh-huh.
They're going to be up to an inch long and white and C-shaped, and they're going to have three pairs of legs, a brown head, and they'll be living right there in the root zone. They feed on the roots. And so even though you're getting your lawn a little bit on the brown side, if you control the grubs and water the turf, the new roots will sprout from the rhizomes. The grass will come back if it hasn't gotten too strawish looking yet.
Yeah, okay.
So a little on the brown side, it'll probably come back. If it looks like straw, it probably won't. You're going to have to overseed or slit seed into those areas.
Okay. So it is the kind of thing where pretty much you don't have to be an entomologist to recognize what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. If they look like, they're just kind of, they're about as big around as your little finger and half an inch to an inch long, full grown or an inch, a little bit more, and C-shaped and soft-bodied. They're pretty easy to figure out what it is. It's the only thing that's going to be in there. It's going to be that big.
And now these are one life stage of a particular kind of beetle?
Mm-hmm. Our good friend, the Japanese beetle
That's what I thought.
There are also two other species of a northern and southern mass chafer that it could be as well, and these are June bug type things. When they're adults, they're half an inch long and tan, heavy bodied, and they will fly to lights at night, typically in the early part of July, late June. But generally, in many areas where you have Japanese beetle, the Japanese beetle has kind of pushed these out and taken over. Particularly in those areas that are irrigated more, you can prevent this insect. I always like to say, allow your grass to get a little bit browner than your neighbor's during July, and they will go to lay eggs in your neighbor's grass instead of yours. Last time I watered my lawn was 1988, the last big drought we had. I'm fortunate to be on a good soil profile, so I'm not trying to grow on clay, which makes a big difference. But when I do research on grubs, I have to look for grubs in somebody else's lawn. I've never had enough. I've never treated for grubs on my own yard.
Wow. Well, this year we've had a pretty dry July and August. What's that going to mean overall for Japanese beetles? Will that mean that next year maybe we won't have a particularly bad year, or it's just there'll be more? It's more. They'll be more evenly spread out.
Well, what we had was a fairly light number of Japanese beetle adults already this year, yeah. Probably a quarter or a third of what we could easily have or have had in the past. The grub, when it hatches out, Japanese beetle grub, needs 11 inches of water through the fall to develop into the adults, to develop into a full-grown larva to deeper in the soil to overwinter. And with our dry in areas where we've had droughty areas and so on, that's likely not getting it there, but many homeowners oblige the Japanese beetle by watering, and so it's normally recommended that to have nice looking grass, you put on an inch of water a week or an inch and a half, and you know, you start doing the counts July, August, September, October. There's 16 weeks and an inch of rain each. They got their 11 inches, so for those people who aren't watering or are allowing their lawn to get a little bit dormant, what I like to say, get it down to where all you have to do is mow the plant and seed heads every few weeks because the grass is kind of brown and not really growing much. Then many times you will, in a dry year like this, you can lose the Japanese beetle grubs. They will die in the turf. But if you're keeping it nice and green and watered, then they're thanking you.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Yes. Recently, it's been in the news about bed bug infestations in some parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was in New York and Philly, thought it might be confined to the Northeast. But recently, I think Detroit, Cincinnati, Columbus, and Dayton in Ohio, Detroit and Michigan,
mm-hmm.
have significant infestations. And, of course, now there's an argument about what can be used by an exterminator that doesn't violate the toxic indoor use rules of the EPA. My question is that a problem that perhaps looms for Illinois and especially East Central Illinois, or are we pretty much out of the in the clear on that?
We've had bed bugs in most parts of Illinois for at least 4 or 5 years in fairly high numbers. How's that for an answer? we have fairly heavily infestations in Chicago proper. Probably every university campus in North America has bed bugs in their dormitories.
No.
So I'm not picking out anybody, but you can assume. And by the way, the University of Illinois Housing has been exceedingly aggressive on this insect and going after it where they can. Unfortunately, one of the interesting sidelights of it is a lot of these get around through international travel. And after 9/11, if you're an international student and you show up as a blip on the radar screen, they take away your student visa. So unfortunately, foreign students who end up getting bed bugs have tried to live with it rather than complain, because they will lose their chance for a college education if they complain. So Homeland Security is very, very tough. If you show up at all showing complaints or anything, that's almost, they are canceling student visas. So so these people are very, very nervous about this, as you might guess. So unfortunately, that's one of the problems. Universities are going in during break times when the dorms are empty and checking for bed bugs and looking for them and trying to be very aggressive on that, and their people have gone to international meetings. I've seen them at several places around the U.S. that I've been going to in bed bugs material, and so universities is and other universities in the state are being very aggressive on that and doing the thing they should be doing. But generally, yeah, the bed bugs problem moves around the state because people move around the country, and primarily it's being moved on people. Bed bugs can live on birds and can move on birds. Birds nesting on the house can bring in bed bugs, but it appears that most of the bed bug problems we have are being moved by people moving. And the bed bugs will come out at night. They will feed on our blood. They will hide in cracks and crevices, and there are many cracks and crevices in our luggage and our other material that we might have in a hotel room or in a friend's house, and we end up moving them around in the process. So bed bugs are getting around and moving around. One of the problems that we have associated with it insecticide-wise is if you look across the United States and you look at all the populations of bed bugs, there is a population which is resistant to each and every insecticide that we have labeled to use on bed bugs at this time. It doesn't mean that the bed bugs that a person might have in their house would not be susceptible, but if you go take a look at it as an overall thing, we've run out of tools that direction. And you say, well, you shouldn't be using insecticides around your bed anyway. For those people that are low economic status, insecticides are probably the only economic option they have. And so it's becoming an economic discriminating problem to a certain extent. For people who – clutter is a real problem with bed bugs because it's hard to get – find the bed bugs, treat the bed bugs, control the bed bugs. There are various – there are some enclosures for mattresses and box springs, such as – one of the more common brand names is Protect-A-Bed. That one's been heavily tested and shown to be effective keeping bed bugs from getting in through the inside or be able to get out of it. There are actually things called interceptors, which look like little plastic moats that you can put around under on your at the bottom of your bedsteads and keep the bed back out from the wall. And so if you can control them in the bedstead and on the bed on the mattress and box spring with the enclosures, then they have to come to you to eat at night, and they come across through this mold area, and it's real smooth on the inside, and they fall in and they can't crawl out. It's just a pitfall trap. There's no insecticide with it. There's no nothing. It's just really smooth walls. The outside they put a little bit of paper tape on so they can crawl up the outside well, but then when they get to the inside, it's and they're stuck. They're not stuck, but they're caught. You can use steam on the bed itself. Dry steam is commonly used. A lot of pest control companies have invested in steamers, which work very well. You have to be slow. That means takes more time, means more money, and also, pest control companies are investing into heat units. Situations where you can take a mattress and box springs, furniture, put it inside something similar to a medium-sized U-Haul trailer, heat it up to 120 degrees, hold it there for a couple hours, and kill all the bed bugs in it. They also have heat generation units. They come with their own generator you have to run because they take so much electricity, but they pump heat up into several stories up into a building through large hoses which run from the unit in the street, and literally raise the temperature of the room, the wall voids, things of this nature, to where it kills the bed bugs. They crawl out of the walls, everything else, trying to get away from heat, and get killed that way. That's a particularly effective method. But as you might guess, all this stuff is expensive. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort, and you can't approach bed bugs with the idea that, well, it costs so much to control roaches per month, it shouldn't be any more for bed bugs. Wrong. You're going to say several times more, and that's where the social economic situation becomes a problem, because people with limited economic means really just can't afford to get rid of their bed bugs. So that becomes a real. We have an insect problem in this country, and it's becoming a cultural problem very quickly because there isn't a cheap way out.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you for the call and the question. And we are getting close to our midpoint here. Phil Nixon is our guest. He is an extension specialist with Natural Resources and Crop Sciences here at the U of I. And every once in a while, he's here, particularly in the summertime. We talk about dealing with insect pest problems. So if you have a bug problem, could be in the house, could be in the home landscape, just call and tell us, give us the best description. If you can tell us what it is, then Phil will tell you how to get rid of it. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something else you said maybe we might talk about is magnolia scale. Something, in fact, you said people might have it and not even know it.
Your magnolia bushes or trees, we've had particularly Farther north, we've had magnolia scale for quite a number of years in the Chicago metro area as being a problem. It has been found in central Illinois, probably as far south as Effingham, and we're seeing kind of an outbreak at this time, or an increase at least. I wouldn't call it an outbreak. But the scale kind of looks like lumps, which are anywhere from a quarter to a half an inch in diameter. And they will be on the stems of a plant, and this can be on bushy type of magnolias, such as star magnolia, as well as the larger tree-like magnolias, saucer magnolias, as long as the magnolia can get on it. And it will even get on to yellow poplar, which is a type of magnolia. People call it tulip tree. And so this insect will get on it. It can increase greatly. They'll look like these quarter-inch to half-inch lumps, and sometimes they're yellowish, but more commonly when I see them, they've got a white bloom across the surface. So they almost look like whitish lumps on twigs. They're sucking the sap out of a plant. They will cause loss of leaves, cause dieback of branches. Heavy enough could kill the plant. Their Achilles heel, the way that we can control them best is that when they get into late September, they produce young called crawlers, which are not protected. The older scale on the tree and the bushes tend to have a hard outside covering that insecticides don't penetrate well. You can spend a good 2 or 3 days trying to clean the scale off a plant mechanically, even a shrub. So insecticides are usually the best answer. But anytime from the latter part of September all the way through the winter, you can get control with a single spray that covers well of an insecticide. Contact insecticides work well, including insecticidal soap, spray oils, oil sprays. They're called dormant oil or summer spray oil sprays. You can get control with pyrethroid insecticides such as permethrin, so it is 8 insect spray. You can get control with other pyrethroids, cyfluthrin, which you'll find is bare advanced multi-insect killer. A variety of ways to control this insect, but the important time is from about the end of September through the winter. Anytime you get out there on a day when it's above freezing a ways, you can get a good coverage. You can kill the little scale sitting there waiting to be big scales next year.
All right. At several callers now. Let's take them in order. First, Champagne, line 1. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. We recently had a real problem with ants, especially around our kitchen, dining room. Even if one little speck of anything has any kind of a sugar content, it seems like, and they're swarming through. We tried all different kinds of things, very conservative things. We're trying to avoid sprays and a lot of things, and nothing seemed effective. And then a friend in our church told us about a little liquid that you put on little patches of paper, like Terol, or
it's called Terro, T-E-R-R-O.
Yeah, what?
And it has
only ingredient I see in that thing is borax.
Yes, it's a boric acid toxicant in it, and it has a sweet base. It was attractive to sweet feeding ants. Another brand that already comes in little bait stations is called Grant's Ant Bait, and it will have a I believe it's also got a boric acid toxin at this point, and it'll work against sweet feeding ants. The
is it
ants
extremely toxic to people, or
it's relatively low in toxicity. People have accidentally been killed by eating the amount of borax that will fit in the palm of your hand. Now that's toxic, but you got to kind of work at it. Okay. It's not likely to be, we look at it as being relatively safe to use as long as it's used properly, but it has to be respected. It does have a toxicity. It's organic, but that doesn't mean that it's totally not non-toxic.
Do you happen to know what the mechanism of action is?
We know that it's essentially an acid which tears the holy bejeebers out of the gut. I mean, okay. You take some acid, and what do you think is going to happen to your stomach and intestines?
Exactly.
So that's pretty well what apparently is done. The exact mechanism isn't totally known, but it appears that that's probably what's happening associated with boric acid. And then there are also ants that will be protein feeders, depending on what they're doing in their colony. The same ant species may switch, and or what people will call grease ants. They're going after protein to feed to their larvae. And in those situations, an insect bait called combat ant bait will be very effective. It has a protein base, a hydromethanon or a fipronil type toxicant there, which are synthetic insecticides, but very low in volatility and relatively low in toxicity. Both of these products are the insecticide of choice to control, well, ants and IV tubes and in nightstands and hospitals and ICU units and pet stores. As you might guess, you got to be kind of careful controlling insects in a pet store, since usually use insects to feed some of those pets that are in there. So this is a very, although it's a synthetic material, it's very safe, probably actually safer than the boric acid, actually.
Tell me this, with the boric acid, we used it for just a few days, and the little patches of paper I put down on the floor that I put several drops of it on, all of a sudden it was all black because there were that many ants on top of it.
Uh-huh.
They swarmed to it like crazy. And then after about 2 days, we never saw another ant. Even after we picked up the paper pieces, threw them away, disposed of them, ants have never come back. Is there some sort of, how does that work? I mean,
the mechanism of all three of these toxicants, where you're looking at boric acid, hydromethanol, or fipronil, is that they're slow-acting insecticide. They take several hours to kill the ant. And ants, being colonial insects, they go back to the colony and they do what's called trophallaxis, which is a fancy word meaning mutual feeding. They will feed each other in the colony. In the process, they spread this insecticide around through the colony before they die, and then it's spread by them, those that they fed it to, before they die. And the idea is that theoretically you're going to kill the nest. What happens many times is, if a nest is an outdoor nest, which is normally the case, the ants are not just using what's in the house as a source of food. They're using other sources of food. And so you may lose a high percentage of a colony, but you may not kill it off completely. And as a result, many times when you use a bait like this, or any way of controlling ants for that matter, you'll have a respite of several weeks, and then they will show up again. And what it indicates is that it takes 6 weeks or so to grow up more ants, and what you're seeing is that you seriously harmed the colony. You didn't take it out, but it took a while to respond and build back up to where it can come back in and start, and members start foraging your house. So you may have them come back in 6 weeks or so, and then you just repeat the process. Long-term answer is trying to find out. They've got to be getting in. If they're coming from the outside, which they probably are, through cracks or crevices, and the best you can do to caulk those types of things will help more permanently control the ant problem.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right, very good. Thank you. So we go next to another caller, and this will be someone in Urbana. Line two, right here. Line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have an identification problem. I have milkweed that I use that I keep for monarchs. Mm-hmm. But I had a different kind of caterpillar on it this year that just destroyed the plants. It was fuzzy.
Real fuzzy and orange and black?
Orange and black, and it had fuzzy, like a fuzzy black fringe around the edge, and then big white things that stuck out of both ends.
This is called the milkweed tiger moth.
Ah.
And it will feed on the milkweeds just like the monarchs do. Personally, I think they're pretty enough. I usually leave them be because normally I don't get very many on them. But certainly, one can hand pick off. You can hand pick off a larvae and control them, or you can spray the plant if you wanted with Bacillus thuringiensis Kerstaki BTK. Now this will kill monarch caterpillars as well. The advantage of it is that if it's essentially all over the plant, you really don't have any monarchs out in the sunlight during the summer. That BT will probably break down within 3 days, maybe five, certainly within 7 days or so. And so new monarchs as well as new tiger moths coming to that plant, and their eggs are laid, larvae will hatch out and should not be bothered. So, you know, if it's to where you can hand pick them off, then looking closely for monarchs and moving them off onto a plant that doesn't have a problem and then spraying those plants might be an option that you might want to pursue
with that
in mind.
I found where they were emerging from their, so it was sort of a cobwebby-looking place.
Yeah, it should be just a cluster of eggs on the, under the leaf, but yeah,
yeah,
but
some, they were some really big clusters, and
okay.
I just picked those off and put them in water.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't had as many.
Okay. Yeah, but yeah, usually hand removal if there's just a few of them on there, and that's usually the case. What you want to do is keep an eye out on them earlier in the season. We seem to have more of those this year than we normally do, which means that somehow the conditions were probably better for them, or they may be fairly numerous here for about 3 years straight and then become less common again. That would be the typical population fluctuation of a native insect, which this is. So you just may want to keep an eye on it, on the milkweeds earlier in the spring. Chances are what you're seeing, there might be an occasional one or two on the milkweeds earlier in the spring. If you take those caterpillars off, that will help reduce the number that get to adulthood. Generally, second generation is much heavier on something like this, and that may be what you're experiencing. I'm not sure if they have two or more generations per year, but considering how long through the season you tend to see them, I suspect that they probably do. So you might want to check earlier in the spring. Start looking in June for them as soon as the milkweeds really are up and doing well, and pick them off there. That may help reduce it so you don't have as many later in the season.
Yeah, I had just never... Well, I might have seen them, but I had never seen hordes of them.
Yeah, I never have either. Normally, if you can find two or three on a good-sized milkweed plant, you're doing well. Usually there's fewer of those than there are monarch caterpillars generally on milkweeds.
Yeah. And another kind of caterpillar is munching on my parsley.
Kind of green with black stripes. Yeah, this would be, in all likelihood, the larva of the black swallowtail butterfly.
Yeah,
and will come out as a 5-inch wingspan butterfly that's got black wings with some bluish markings on it, and swallowtails off the end. I actually, in my garden, have planted particularly fennel and parsley, dill. They really love dill and fennel more than they do parsley, and they will feed on carrots as well. Usually, as long as there's not very many caterpillars, you can coexist with them. You eat part of the foliage, they eat part of the foliage, and you can kind of get along because you get those nice butterflies, and they're really not all that voracious feeders generally.
Yeah, I just saw them. They're not doing any major destruction, and I thought they would be butterflies, and I wanted to know what kind.
Yeah, black swallowtails. Interesting feature is if you hassle one enough and they think that they're threatened, they will push out what's called an osmeterium, a fork-like orange structure out of their head, which if you're real close, it really stinks to high heaven. That's their method of defense. So it's kind of funny.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Our guest this morning, this hour of Focus, is Phil Nixon. He's an extension specialist in the Department of Natural Resources and Crop Sciences. And that's right?
Just crop sciences.
Okay. This is what I got from the website. You're going to get them to fix that.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, well most of the horticulturists and people allied to horticulture moved from the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences last August into the Department of Crop Sciences. So, you know how quick we are updating things on the web.
All right. Ask for him by name, Phil Nixon. He is here, and we're taking your questions on insect pest problems in the home and in the garden. And if you got a question, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-94. See, we take our time to fix things around here, too.
Yeah, well, you know.
All right. Let's go to line three, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I tuned in at the end of the bed bug conversation, and I have a curiosity question.
Sure.
Are you safer if you're sleeping on a waterbed?
No. If you're sleeping on an air-conditioned waterbed, perhaps, but because they're going to like temperatures up in the 70s. But generally, if it's comfortable for you, it's comfortable for bed bugs, and in fact, bed bugs are very cold-tolerant. So I don't see that there's any real difference. In fact, generally, bed bugs aren't going to get inside the mattress itself. The mattress enclosure is more for the beds, for the box springs than it is for the mattress, because there are areas where they can get in on box springs. But on mattresses, you may have noticed that the only openings in a mattress, if it's in good shape, is this little brass plate that has little tiny holes in it. Do you ever wonder why they figured out how small to make those holes? Those holes are small enough to keep bed bugs, even when they're real young, out of the inside of a mattress. That's why those holes are engineered that way. They figured that out back in the 20s and 30s, the last time we had bed bugs as a problem in this country, and they've been using the same size holes ever since. So most of the time, they're not going to get inside our bed bugs. The mattress has to breathe back and forth because air has to move out as we lay on it. But those holes are meant to keep out, are small enough to keep out bed bugs. That's why they're the size they are. But on the box springs, they'll get into that. But to my knowledge, it makes no difference whether you have a water bed or a standard mattress. That bed bugs are just as likely in either case.
I see. And the heater on a water bed, would turning that up and not sleeping on it be enough to move the bed bugs away?
You'd have to get it up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, and then you might be compromising some of the seals on your waterbed.
I see.
I don't know that for sure. I would guess maybe it would probably take another 100 degrees or so, but I'm not certain, or another 60 degrees. But I would imagine that the heater doesn't go up that high in the first place. It would have to get up to at least 120 degrees and maintain it. And what it would do is it would cause the bed bugs to leave the waterbed to get somewhere else in your room.
Okay.
And then come back when it cooled down.
I'm still hoping we don't get them, so thank you very much.
All right, that's a good hope to have.
Well, and I got an email here from somebody who also was listening to the conversation, and his question is, well, suppose that you are traveling, uh-huh, and a bed bug gets into your stuff,
right,
and you end up bringing it home with you. He's wondering, well, is one enough to infest your house, or do you have to have two or more?
As with most other things, if she's pregnant, it only takes one.
Okay.
If it's a guy, no. If she happens to be a virgin, no. But if she's pregnant, yes, that's
uh-huh,
enough.
Okay. And if you are traveling, is there anything that you can do to reduce the chances that you might bring some home with you?
Well, what I do when I go into a hotel room, or I will look, the ideal thing that you would look is you would pull the bed, tear the bed apart, look on the underneath side of the box springs, tear the charcoal foam-like covering that's on the underside of a box spring off and look there. That's the number one place for bed bugs to hide out. You might have a serious damage deposit problem there in a hotel if you did that. Commonly what I will do is a lot of people will pull off the sheets and look in the seams of a mattress and the box springs to see if they can see any signs of dark spots. Bed bugs feed on blood, human blood, other bird and mammal blood. They will feed on your dog and cat too, by the way. And partially digested blood will look like black spots, but they defecate. And so that's what you look for. And another place to look in, what I've done quite a bit, is usually in a hotel room, the bedboard is attached to the wall. It's just kind of hung up there on a rail. And you can lift that off, particularly if you've got somebody to help you. And you look on the back side of that, and particularly where that rail was in contact with the headboard, and look for the black spots. Usually that's fairly commonly heavy, and I'm in a room by myself, so I more commonly look around the edges of the backs of the bedside table, pull out the drawer, look at the edges of that. Anything that's very close to the bed, look for black spots. And recently I've even gone to carrying a flashlight that shines ultraviolet light, and the fecal matter of a bed bug will fluoresce under ultraviolet light, will look whitish. Unfortunately, and this may be something you don't want to get into, because essentially any type of exudate from a human or other creature will also fluoresce. So you may not want to know what's dried and on the outside of that bedstead. You know, it's whatever. You let your mind wander. It could go everywhere. Okay. As well as face powder will fluoresce, body powder. It's fairly common to see things fluorescing when you do that in a dark room in a hotel. So some people I've talked to said, I don't really want to see all that. So at any rate, that's another method that I've been using, And so these are ways that we'll check. A good way to do it is to not have your suitcase open during the night. Several entomologists that I know close their suitcase at night when they're in a room with the idea that the zippers and so on should help keep bed bugs from crawling into your suitcase. Similarly, computer bags, things of that nature. So these are all things that you can do, but I do check out the room when I go into it. I'm out on the road a lot. My job is to run around the state of Illinois and do two-day programs all winter. And so I'm commonly in hotel rooms 60 to 70 nights a year. I've been doing this for 23 years. I've yet to run across bed bugs in any of the hotels I've stayed in.
Okay. And so
it's not a dead common thing. It's out there. You can easily pick it up. But it's not something like it's anywhere near a surety. And, of course, hotels, as you might guess, have been on top of this thing for several years and trying to get on top of it, and they have become more aggressive. Initially, there was a lot of denial about it, but now they're becoming much more aggressive, and they're doing a much better job at trying to keep this from being a source of how bedbugs get around the country and move around.
And the listener was also wondering, you talked about the thing that you set the feet of the bed frame in, so that then the idea is that's supposed to keep them from crawling up the legs,
right,
getting onto the bed, then getting on you.
That's correct.
Wanted to know, is there a name for that?
It's called Interceptor.
Interceptor.
Interceptor is a brand name. You could probably buy it off a web. I don't know. I don't think I've ever seen it in a hardware store or any other places that sells pest control products. But pretty much many pest control companies will retail products to the public, and so you can contact one of those. They may be able to get them for you. But it's called Interceptor. It's essentially cups that are about 6 inches across. Yeah, Interceptor gets you all kinds of things on a Google SERP. The bed bug interceptors will probably get you more than David's checking right now. So. It should pop up. I have found it before on the internet pretty easily.
For example, here looks like you can get one from Amazon.
Okay.
Interceptor bed bug trap. Yeah. Okay. So then, if you're interested, you can go on the web and do that.
These have been on the market for about 2 years. They've really been working well, and don't feel like you have to put anything in the moat. They're smooth enough that bed bugs can't get their footing.
Okay. Looks like there are a lot of places that you can get them from. Let's go here back to the phones, and we've got somebody on a cell phone, line 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, hi.
I have two questions. One is, we had this summer just regular housewives, but four of them started living like on the top of, we have these heads-like bushes. I don't know what kind they are. They're just green. They don't have flowers on them, but
okay.
Like hordes of them were suddenly living, you know, especially in the hot afternoons, it seemed like they would be near the top of that. And I was wondering, why are they, they're not eating the bushes. What are they going to the bushes for?
Okay.
What do we do to get rid of them?
These are live. They're not dead, right?
Right.
Because there is a fungus that causes flies to land on the perch on the tip of little twigs and die. And so sometimes you find dead flies all over the tips of twigs. This probably what you've got is a bush that may have aphids on it that are producing honeydew, which is partially processed sap coming from a plant through the aphid and is defecated there. Flies will be attracted to that. There may be what we call foliar nectaries, although this is more common on tropical plants. There are a few temperate plants that will have these. They'll actually produce sap many times towards the base the flies be attracted to. And then another possibility, perhaps the strongest possibility, is that you may have a shrub which produces green flowers that you're not really noticing, and they may be very small and not very noticeable, and the flies are being attracted to that and feeding on that, particularly if you find it on one particular type of shrub. Some of the viburnums, which tend to be spring bloomers, will bloom green, and the average person doesn't notice the blossoms. The blossoms are only a quarter of an inch across or something like this, and there's a group of them. And this can be attractive to flies and bees and other insects. So that may be a factor. My suggestion would be perhaps if you have a shrub like this that's next to the doorway you use a lot, you might want to transplant it or get a new one that you plant somewhere else away from it. But otherwise, I'd go up and live and let live sort of thing. Flies flying around, even large numbers of them, as long as they're not getting in your house and not bothering you, you know, that's their place too. It's kind of the way I look at it. I would not spray them because they may be coming to some sort of flower that you may be inadvertently killing some other insects that would be coming there that you really didn't want to bother, like bees.
We used to fly one of those fly traps where they fly in and then they die. And that seemed to work to some degree, but again, then it would just come back again.
Yeah, generally the fly traps are going to just harvest the flies. They're not going to get rid of a problem. And I think more commonly than not, you get a feeling of satisfaction. At least you got those that are in the trap, but you probably didn't do a whole lot to the fly situation in general.
Is this a bad year for flies?
Well, with all the rain we had earlier in the spring, you got a lot of dead or wet, damp organic matter, which is ideal food source for fly larvae. Yeah, so. So that could increase the number of flies, but I haven't noticed more flies than normal around myself in my own area.
Okay, my second question was about spiders. It seems like we're getting a whole lot of spiders in the garage. Is this a particularly bad year for spiders?
And well, they like moist conditions as well, and so they may have done better in the spring than they do sometimes. As they get older, they can handle the drier conditions better, which we've had in the last few weeks. But they're also, this is the time of year when spiders are maturing and getting older and they're starting to move around. They're becoming adults, and when they become adults, they start thinking about sex. When they start thinking about sex, they start looking for the opposite sex. So a lot of these are males that are roaming around looking for females and, somewhat similar to the mall on a Saturday night. But at any rate, but they will be coming in through cracks and crevices, and caulking cracks and crevices will help. Keep things clean of clutter and so on so they don't have a lot of places to hide would be more than anything else. In general, most spiders are not going to be a serious problem. If you want to spray with an aerosol ant and roach spray, that will help some, but it's not real effective against spiders. Insecticide dusts are more effective, but still, generally, if they don't have a lot of places to hide, you don't end up with a lot of spiders. They're going to move on to somewhere where they can hide. They're going to check out the area and then go on.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Let's go over to Vermilion County, line number 4, for another caller. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I have two unrelated questions. Number one, I have some crickets chirping in my basement. Can't seem to find them to get them. Is there anything similar to a mouse trap for crickets? And also, if I don't get them, does that mean they're going to reproduce and possibly eat books and things that are down there?
If what you have are field crickets, that is the dark brown to blackish crickets, they will normally only live inside a house once they get inside for about 2 weeks and die because it's not damp enough. It's not the right conditions for them to survive, even in a fairly damp basement. And of course, you got a damp basement, you got mildew problems on your books, so you shouldn't have them there anyway. There are no traps that I'm aware of for a trap. There are cricket baits that are used outdoors around in some situations have been used in the past. I'm not really certain whether they're still available. I haven't noticed them for several years. But generally, cricket inside is not going to be a real problem. They're going to die within a relatively short time, a couple of weeks. If you notice a wall that are along, you can spray the cracks or crevices along that wall where maybe the wall meets the floor, wherever you might hear it, with an aerosol ant and roach spray. The cricket will get into it and get killed. If you want to go that far to do that.
Second question. If I don't empty my compost bucket at night when I do the dishes, sometimes I find little brown things that look like small grains of brown rice. Are those from fruit flies?
Those are probably the pupal stages of fruit flies, which would indicate that maybe the compost bucket hadn't been dumped for about 2 weeks. Because it takes about 2 weeks for the larvae to develop into it. Or that also means that you may have some, or you may not be cleaning out the corners. They may be hiding in the corners. The larvae are relatively small. But fruit fly pupae are going to be eighth of an inch or so and very slender elongated capsules. And so that's likely what you're seeing. And that's and a little more sanitation would probably help on that. It may be that fruit flies can attack stored onions, potatoes, as well as fruit and so on. So it may be that you may already have an infestation starting in your potatoes or onions or something like that. And so you may have larvae that you're not aware of that are already being thrown in there in the peelings that are pupating fairly quick. You may want to check some of those sources.
Or if you have some fruit in a bowl, like ripening on the counter or something like that.
Yeah, but it would need to be there for 10 days or so to get to the pupal stage, or at least a week. Yeah, so generally it's going to take longer than most people are going to leave sitting out, because if nothing else, it's going to dry up before that time.
Yeah, okay. So, like, if the onions were in the pantry?
Yeah, they'll find it.
But then they would come over to the counter near the compost bucket?
My point is that if you're preparing the onions and you've got onion peelings that you've then put in the compost bucket, then the larvae may come out and pupate from the peelings that you put in the bucket, although they started in the onions in the bag in the pantry. That was my point.
Okay.
Time
doesn't make sense, but okay. Thanks.
Well, if they're already developing in the vegetables and then you peel the vegetables and then the peelings are part of a larvae, you put them in a compost bucket, then they may be already partially grown larvae by the time they went in the compost bucket. That's what I'm trying to say.
We're at the point where we're going to have to finish up any case and say thanks to Phil for being here this summer. We appreciate you giving us so much of your time to answer questions.
Sure, glad to do so.
Phil Nixon is an extension specialist in the Department of Crop Sciences.
Very good.
Thank you very much. And, of course, in the meantime, people have questions. Maybe the easiest thing to do is contact whatever is their local, their closest extension person. And they can help. And then if they can't answer the question, then the guy that they talk to is Phil.
That's correct.
All right. And we'll have more bug talk in the next hour of the show, but it will be very different now. I hope we got our extension stuff done.
And you can be careful. She's from the Department of Entomology.
I think I can get that one right.
Okay.
We'll see if we do. Hey, thanks very much, Phil.